Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. As the state takes a big step toward reopening its economy, COVID-19 continues to spread in the Granite State. Police practices come under continued scrutiny, with calls for an end to protections for police who unduly violate someone's civil rights. And on this Juneteenth, we'll take stock of events commemorating the end of slavery. These and other stories unfolded this week and continue to unfold, and you can join the conversation about them by phone. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. First, we're going to talk about Juneteenth events happening in New Hampshire. Juneteenth, also known as Freedom Day, commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. Governor Sununu declared Juneteenth the state holiday last year. With me right now, Jerry Ann Bogus, executive director of the Black Heritage Trail in Portsmouth and an organizer of the Juneteenth events on the seacoast. Tia Parker, one of the organizers for the Juneteenth celebration in Manchester. And Ed Taylor, digital director of NextGen New Hampshire, which is partnering with the Delta Sigma Theta sorority chapter at Dartmouth for a virtual town hall called Juneteenth Conversation about Being Black at a Predominantly White Institution. Thank you all very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Later this hour, we're going to be speaking with NHPR's Jason Moon and Ethan DeWitt of other news items of note this week. But starting with Juneteenth and starting with you, Jerry Ann, and I'd like to hear from all of you on this. What does Juneteenth mean to you right now in this moment?
Well, right now, contrary to popular thought, we've known about Juneteenth for a very long time. In fact, in Portsmouth from the 1990s, New Hope Baptist Church had been celebrating Juneteenth, and the Black Heritage Trail, we're in our fourth year of celebrating this event. And it really signals a time when we can really honestly look at Americans' history. You know, we celebrate the 4th of July every year, widely celebrated, but on the signing of that declaration, 500,000 African and African Americans were enslaved. So it wasn't until June 19th now I'm blanking on his name.
General Garrison, I think?
Garrison, thank you so much. Marched into Galveston, Texas with a troop of soldiers that we could actually say that the real battle and journey towards freedom started in our country. And that was in 1865. Mm-hmm. So it really does it really then speaks true to saying that all men are free, not July 4th, but July 19th, mm-hmm. the start of that journey.
And Tia Parker, what about you? What does Juneteenth mean to you now in this moment?
Reflecting back what has already been said, Juneteenth for me is an Independence Day. Growing up, being African-American in a place much like Manchester, where I'm a minority, I grew up on the West Coast, where there was mostly white and Asian people in my city, but we did have a very strong Black community, especially my family were big pillars in education in my town and made sure that events like Kwanzaa and Juneteenth happened every year. And I'm 30, and I've never known a year where I didn't celebrate Juneteenth in some way. Mm-hmm. And I want to express more of that in the time that we are now, that everybody's ears are open and willing to hear the issues and inequality that are still going on as the ramifications of slavery, and really celebrate that and make it more of a norm.
And what about you, Ed? The meaning of Juneteenth for you?
I would say, as being Black from the South, a descendant of enslaved people from South Georgia, I went to an HBCU. So the history and the spirit of Juneteenth runs in my veins and is deeply ingrained in who I am. And then I would say again that today is my birthday. So I like to say that the universe is giving me strong signs that I'm in
happy
the work.
That,
thank
birthday.
You. I appreciate that. Thank you. That, you know, happy Juneteenth to you all. But that the universe is giving me strong signs that this is the work that I'm supposed to be in. That, you know, the liberation, that the freedom of our people is finally being acknowledged on the day that it matters.
Mm-hmm. And so how are you considering the current nationwide conversation around police brutality and systemic racism, including energy towards change in New Hampshire that we've seen over the last few weeks? Is this being folded into your events somehow? We'll start with you, Jerry Ann.
Absolutely. All of our events by the Black Heritage Trail have an educational piece, and we always look at the history of enslavement and how that is still being felt today. I mean, our country has never had a reconciliation, a talk about a national dialogue on slavery and what this means. So we will continue to feel its effects until we come to grips with that and have a talk about it. Our programs this year is focused on food and music, and how African Americans have used both all their creativity to combat this oppression, and we've created so much that adds to the fabric of American culture and carried internationally, from soul food to jazz. So we were looking at, you know, that food talks about a culture and its history and its carried through. It's who we are. It's the fabric of who we are. And our enslaved people were never given, you know, the best cuts of meat. In fact, they had to use what was thrown off, left over, you know, to create these sumptuous meals that made them survive. So when we're talking about these things, we always wrap it up in this resilience. We're celebrating a resilient culture. We're celebrating a creative culture. We're celebrating a way of moving beyond what other people think we are to who we know we are, and creating things often out of nothing. And these things help to break some of the stereotypes of who we think African Americans are, who we think Black folks are, you know?
Mm-hmm. So that, to be clear, that the what you are doing today is not a protest by any means. It's not explicitly protesting police brutality, but it is more a celebration of what you are able to do now?
Absolutely. We're celebrating our culture. And part of it also, one of our event today at 1 o'clock is at the African Burying Ground in Portsmouth, a burying ground that was covered over, built upon, and the New Hampshire's history of enslavement erased. So we always, in the African tradition, honor the ancestors. So we'll be having live drumming and dancing at the African Burying Ground Memorial in Portsmouth to honor that history, that tradition, the telling the story of the separation from culture, but recognizing the strength of the people who actually survived enslavement in the country.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Tia? In this moment, we've seen a lot of conversation around police brutality, systemic racism. Is that somehow figuring into the events that you've planned, or are you following Jerry-Ann Bogus's model there?
We're kind of doing a mix of all of it. I wanted to empower the Black Lives Matter movement that is happening here. I personally know the young adults that are running the Nashua and Manchester chapter, and I did have a conversation with them about what they would want to see out of this. And also, of course, putting in the African-American Black influence, we do have speakers that will speak on
food and the African-American experience, singers, performers, and different things. We're working with Manchester Connects, who's building a scavenger hunt with different African-American inventions and things that affect the city of Manchester, and some great history that's enriched in this city to enlighten people. We have a COVID testing center we're doing with the YWCA this afternoon, and I've been reaching out to especially people who have been protesting and rallying to go get tested so they can continue their message and know whether they've come in contact with somebody and not endanger anybody who wants to continue protesting.
Mm-hmm. And Tia, could I pause you for a moment there? Because that seems really significant. I just want to dive into that. Why did you decide to have COVID-19 testing as part of your Juneteenth celebration?
It was a conversation, actually a few months. I was inspired by what Portsmouth did last year and having several conversations with other Black people I know personally as friends in this area, that we really wanted Manchester, as one of the biggest cities in New Hampshire, to have a Juneteenth, because it's very important to me. And it was something that I really thought that was important for me to see growing up in a place where I was a minority, to see strong Black people having this. But also the conversation has been happening with Black Lives Matter, that people are really listening. When I went to that rally, the first one we had here in Manchester, right after things really got to a head, there was 1,000+ people. And I really thought, like, I'd maybe see 200 people there. And I was moved to see how many of our neighbors were ready to listen. And I know many of us are ready to have that conversation, and I want to continue to have that conversation. I don't want it to end with the hashtag. And since all of us have been out and proactive, like, we can't deny that there is something out there, but we have the means to protect ourselves and still get the message out there. We can still social distance and wear our masks and make sure that our hands are clean and we're being safe neighbors and get our message out there. I don't want the message to be confused and that those that are out there protesting and rallying are being dangerous and reckless when we do have the means to get tested. So I want to, as much as I can, set up those resources so our voices will continue to be amplified.
So just to drill down on the details a little more, so people who want to get tested for COVID-19, do they need an appointment? Can they just walk up? What do they need to do?
Yes, you need an appointment. There's just a number you can call, and within a couple of hours, even if you called this morning, try to call as soon as possible. We're starting at 1:00. They will see you. If you can't be seen today, we are making other dates to make it possible, because just outreach, and especially things like this where you don't feel like you have the access to, a lot of places I know have only been doing drive-up. And, you know, fact of the matter is there are some people who don't have a car. And maybe don't have the access. So I want to make it, you know, as visible as possible. Like, do your part and just get tested, especially since the resources are there.
Great. So Tia, where can I go, or where can folks go if they want to get the phone number to make an appointment?
If you want to get the phone number to look it up, you can look up, you can call the YWCA today. You can look up on our social media. Just look up Juneteenth Manchester on Facebook and Instagram. And we have many graphics and pictures and people available to message with you to make sure that you get an appointment.
Great.
There's a number to call.
Great. Okay. So we'll see if we can get the link up to that, the Juneteenth Manchester Facebook page up at our website.
Yeah, if you give me just a second, I can bring up the number.
Sure. We'll circle back to you for that.
Yes.
But for now, let's go to Ed for a moment, because Ed, I want to hear a little bit about your planned events and whether or not the conversation about police brutality and systemic racism is involved in your events somehow.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that's the full answer. Yes, full stop. Our event will be with Delta Sigma Theta, which is one of the four Black sororities founded in 1913 at Howard University. And it's going to be a conversation, one, of course, around the history of Juneteenth, but then hearing these young women's stories about what it's like to be a Black woman at Dartmouth, an institution that was not built to educate Black people and was definitely and especially not built to educate women of color. So hearing their story, hearing how an institution like Dartmouth still holds on to those pains and you know are still felt today by so many marginalized populations at Dartmouth, hearing their stories, hearing their testimony is gonna be very powerful. And I absolutely believe it will encompass some of these national moments.
Ed, what I heard from Jerry Ann and Tia is that these events really have the spirit of, I don't know how to describe it. Maybe the way to describe it is the opposite of erasure, right? Instead of being erased and covered up and hidden, you're announcing essentially, we're here. We need to be seen. We need to be understood. Is that kind of the spirit of what you're holding as well?
Absolutely. Again, as being a Black kid from the South and coming to a place like New Hampshire, I didn't see myself very often. But I knew that stories like mine, stories like the women who go to Dartmouth, their stories matter deeply and they deserve to be heard by everyone.
Jerrianne Bogus, what do you hope will come out of both today's celebration and the big conversations about racial injustice happening now? What do you hope comes out of those going forward?
So one of the things that we're doing in returning Black history to our collective memory is just doing that, telling these stories. So we can no longer say that, especially here in New Hampshire, the notion that New Hampshire is a white state. New Hampshire has a long history of African and African Americans and Black people living here and contributing to the culture. So once we start these dialogues, once we make these stories, we remember these stories, we recollect them, we make this Black history visible with sculptures and with memorials like the African Burying Ground. It's returning those stories here. And through that, we have a points for dialogue to discuss through history, through the lens of history, through current issues, where we are. And once people start talking, start communicating, start understanding each other, those racialized barriers, those stereotypes have to break down. The more we converse, the more we talk, the more we understand each other. And so it is a step towards that reconciliation that's needed, you know, to repair the damage done to the country by enslavement of Africans here. So I do hope that the more we make the story visible, the more we talk about it, the closer we're taking that step to really be an inclusive community and, you know, live up to the values that we say are American values.
How about you, Tia? What do you hope comes out of both this national conversation and these celebrations planned for today?
I'm really hoping for Juneteenth to be normalized and celebrated every year. We celebrate other cultural holidays such as Cinco de Mayo and in St. Patrick's Day pretty normally, and it's in American culture. And I feel like no reason we shouldn't have African-American Black holidays is the same. I really want to feel comfortable in the skin I am and have, you know, people appreciate my heritage and my culture, not as just some side thing that I do with my family, but something we all do together.
And Ed, what do you hope comes out of the Juneteenth celebrations and the national conversation?
Most definitely. Well, first, I'd like to say that you can find our events at Next Gen New Hampshire on Facebook. But we're looking for a national day of designation for Juneteenth as a national holiday, as a fight for racial justice. And folks can sign into our petition by texting Juneteenth to 82623 to get the petition to sign on, because Black history is American history. And it's time that folks start realizing that.
Well, Ed Taylor, Digital Director for Next Gen New Hampshire, thank you very much for joining me today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Ed's information, by the way, Next Gen NH on Facebook. Tia Parker, before we say goodbye to you, did you have that phone number for people who want to make a COVID-19 appointment today in Manchester?
I will get you that phone number. Area code 603-668-1547. And it starts at 1, ends at 5 today. Just call as soon as possible so they can set you an appointment.
Tia Parker, one of the organizers for the Juneteenth celebration in Manchester. Thanks very much. Jerrianne Bogus, Executive Director of the Black Heritage Trail in Portsmouth. Thank you very much. And as we say goodbye to you, could you let us know how we could find more information? Is there a website or a Facebook page for the events taking place today?
Absolutely. You can visit us at blackheritagetrailnh.org for the list of events. There are three more events that we have slated for, two for today and one for tomorrow. And they are on our website, blackheritagetrailnh.org.
Well, Jerry Ann Bogus, thank you very much again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, we just gave a lot of information about websites to visit, and we are going to put links to all that on our website as well. So fear not if you've missed it. You'll get another opportunity to find links and hear that phone number for scheduling COVID-19 appointments in New Hampshire today. We're taking a look back at a busy week in news here in the Granite State. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back on Tuesday, the state unveiled its new visitation plan for long-term care homes. Every facility is required to develop an individual plan that is tailored to meet their needs and safety. Long-term care facilities, of course, have borne the brunt of COVID-19 deaths. What do you think about the state's plan? Whether you live in one of these facilities or have a loved one that does, please tell us your story. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. Monday on The Exchange, talking to young children about race. As books about systemic racism rise to the top of bestseller lists and calls for action against systemic oppression and daily microaggressions dominate social media, we talk about the effective ways to have conversations with children about race and how those conversations look different based on your background, geography, and personal history. That's coming up at 9 o'clock on Monday on The Exchange. Right now, we're taking a look back at the week in New Hampshire news with a few knowledgeable people. NHPR's Jason Moon is with us, as is Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor. Thanks to both of you for being here today.
Morning, Peter.
Thanks for having us.
So we're going to start with a COVID-19 update, and later in the program, going to take a look at how the state Senate has been getting its work done. Call us if you have questions or comments, particularly about the state's new plan for long-term care facility visitations. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email your questions or comments to exchange@nhpr.org. The state on Tuesday unveiled its new visitation plan for long-term care homes. Every facility is required to develop an individual plan that is tailored to their needs and safety. The visits will be no-contact visits outside, limited to 2 people and no one under the age of 12, and by appointment. Residents will continue to be screened regularly, and visitors will be screened before visits. And visits will only be at facilities that are not experiencing an outbreak. Residents at long-term care facilities account for nearly 80% of coronavirus deaths in the state. NHPR's Jason Moon, you've been reporting just a few weeks ago that some nursing homes are struggling to get enough PPE. So how are nursing homes preparing for these visits?
Carefully, I would say.
Carefully.
Everyone knows the stakes of this, because as you pointed out, you know, the vast majority of the deaths from COVID-19 in New Hampshire have occurred at these facilities. And we should point out one other stipulation to the guidelines is that at facilities that still have active outbreaks, those facilities are still barred from having any visitation. So for the roughly dozen facilities where there's still an ongoing outbreak, they cannot have visitors still. For those who don't have active outbreaks, who are planning these visits, you know, I've heard of people buying large tents to set up, you know, on the lawn out in front of the nursing homes, people getting ready for a flood of requests for visitations. I mean, remember, it's been, you know, over 3 months now that people inside have been really isolated. And I think that's worth just remembering that there is a real long-term and, you know, mental health impact of that kind of isolation, where you have people who've been, you know, basically alone, except for their caregivers or maybe a roommate in these facilities, not having seen their families for a really long time now.
So that would be the risk reward calculation that these nursing homes in the state is doing. Like, yes, it would be perfectly safe to, or maybe safer to not let any of these visits happen, but people are lonely. People really miss their families and their friends.
Yeah, exactly. And
And I just think it is worth thinking about that in terms of a mental health capacity. It's not just that, you know, it'd be nice to see a relative, but this kind of isolation for this long for people who are in a long-term care facility, it can have a real mental health impact. So that definitely is part of the calculation. But as I said, still it is a fraught process, and administrators of nursing homes are very aware of this. I talked to one, Ray Bauer, who runs the Riverside Rest Home in Dover. They are going to be allowing visits pretty soon, but as you'll hear in this tape here, he's a little nervous about it.
I absolutely have anxieties about it. I mean, I understand the necessity of doing it, you know, for the sake of the residents, but yes, you know, the more outward exposure our residents have, the more likely it is for them to come in contact, you know, with someone that's a shedder of you know, COVID. So yes, I have anxiety about it.
So not without some anxiety moving forward in this way.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jason.
I'll just point out that, you know, that unfortunately this the steps that have been taken so far at a lot of the long-term care facilities in terms of screening people for symptoms, staff for symptoms, you know, it hasn't always worked. So that therein lies the risk where, you know, for months now, every nursing home in the state has been screening their staff. You know, if they have symptoms, they tell them they can't come into work today. And it's still getting into long-term care facilities. Now, the difference with family visitation is that there will be a distance maintained and they won't, you know, be coming within 6 feet, whereas the staff really can't avoid coming in 6 feet of the residents. So that makes it a bit safer. But
and the visitations would be outside, whereas staff often interact with the patients or
exactly,
residents inside.
Exactly. So it's not as dangerous, certainly, as the staff involvement might be, but it's still a risk. And people are very aware of that. And the last thing anyone would want, of course, is for, you know, visitations to lead to an outbreak at these facilities where we've seen they can be just so deadly.
Listeners, if you have a question or comment about this new policy, give us a call now. We'll try to get it answered for you. Phone number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email exchange@nhpr.org. We got this note from Brad in Sandown, who writes, I have a question concerning the state's statistics about COVID-19 deaths. Sadly, my mom recently passed away from the coronavirus on May 30th at the age of 93. She contracted the virus in her assisted living facility in Manchester, where she began showing symptoms on May 18th and went into the hospital on May 20th. Her condition declined rapidly, and she died 10 days later at CMC. I was very fortunate and extremely grateful to be able to visit her just hours before her death. My question is this. If a resident becomes infected with COVID-19 at their assisted living facility or nursing home, yet passes away at a hospital or hospice center, is their death counted as a death at their assisted living facility and nursing home? My suspicion is that they are not, because technically they did not die there, but they did contract the virus there, which ultimately led to their death. Jason, do you know the answer to that question?
Yeah, my understanding is that death would be counted as part of the deaths related to the nursing homes. The way the state has been reporting the deaths is deaths related to an outbreak at a particular nursing home facility. So they're not saying, you know, specifically occurred at that facility. So yes, as far as I know, those deaths, if someone was transferred out of a nursing home into a hospital, dies at the hospital, their death is still reported as one that's associated with that particular outbreak at that nursing home.
Brad, thank you very much for the question, and so sorry for the loss of your mother. Jason Moon, you reported that the state Senate signed off on an additional $25 million in federal relief aid to these facilities. Do you know what that would be used for?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that, you know, we don't talk as much about it for nursing homes as we have for hospitals and other medical providers, but the coronavirus has been an extremely hard financial hit for these facilities. And we talk about what's going on, you know, with the outbreaks and the residents, and as we should. But meanwhile, these places are really hemorrhaging money. For one, their PPE costs are through the roof because, you know, medical gowns, gloves, hand sanitizer, masks, they all cost, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 times what they did before the pandemic. And now we need, they need more of them than ever. So there are real strains financially in that sense. And also, you know, there aren't a lot of people who are looking to move into nursing homes right now. So there aren't a ton of new customers, as you might imagine, for some of these facilities. So this money that was put forward in a bill backed by Senate Democrats would look to shore up those facilities to make up for some of that loss. It would be in addition to the $30 million in state funds that have already been committed by Governor Chris Sununu for that same purpose. So it's, you know, it's really just a recognition that along with the human impact of the virus in these facilities, there's also a really significant financial impact as well.
And Jason, you reported that the federal government recently began requiring nursing homes across the country to report data related to the COVID-19 pandemic on a weekly basis. I'm not sure if you've seen those numbers yet.
Yes.
So what have they said? Have they told a story of any kind?
Well, it's still early, and we're waiting to see if you know what data points become trends. But one thing we have seen relates to this issue of the PPE shortage. And these numbers, they're required by the federal government, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, and they ask a whole slew of questions of every nursing home in the country, including, do you have enough medical gowns for 1 week? Do you have enough gloves for 1 week? Do you have enough hand sanitizer for 1 week? And, you know, we were surprised to see that in some of the responses from, you know, at the end of May, so it's the data is a bit old at this point. We're looking for the next week pretty soon. But a large percentage of nursing homes were reporting that they didn't have a 1 week supply of some of that PPE. And in talking to some of the nursing homes, what we discovered is that the idea of a shortage of PPE has really changed and is sort of in the eye of the beholder at this point. And what I mean by that is a lot of these facilities, they're marking that they have a shortage of, say, medical gowns because they are reusing medical gowns in ways that they would not have before the pandemic. So they're getting more use per PPE item than they would have before. And because of that, they're instructed actually to say they have a shortage. But when you call up that nursing home administrator and ask them if they have a shortage, they say, no, actually, we're good. But that's sort of because they are reusing and using the PPE in ways that they weren't necessarily designed for or that they definitely would not have done before the pandemic. So it kind of becomes this question of by what standard are we measuring a shortage of PPE? If we're talking about pre-pandemic standards, yes, it seems a lot of nursing homes are still short on a lot of PPE. If we're talking about the kind of new standard of what's acceptable given the state of the pandemic, then by and large, nursing homes in New Hampshire have what they need. But it's a kind of an interesting question to decide, you know, what we consider or what we're willing to live with as a shortage in PPE at this point.
And of course, the COVID-19 story is developing, and you can find the latest updates at nhpr.org. Other stories that made headlines this week, New Hampshire saw a small uptick in weekly unemployment claims in early June. The U.S. Department of Labor reports there were around 6,300 first-time filers in each of the first 2 weeks of June. That was up slightly from the 6,100 new claims for the week ending May 30th. New Hampshire unemployment rate stood at 14.5% last month. Also, lawyers say a man should not be allowed to sue over a Nashua face covering ordinance and the governor's declaration of a state of emergency because he has not cited any specific harm. A judge held a hearing yesterday in Andrew Cooper's request to block the emergency declaration and the city's face mask rules while his lawsuit proceeds. His attorney argued that the state hasn't demonstrated that restrictions meant to prevent the spread of the coronavirus have worked and that the city lacks the authority to require face coverings to be worn in public. And southern New Hampshire looks to be headed for a drought this summer. The state got about half an inch of rain on May 15th, and since then, less than an inch of rain total has fallen in southern New Hampshire, as much as three quarters less than normal. This also comes after a low snow winter when water reserves typically recharge for the summer. towns and water companies should soon begin imposing, could soon rather begin imposing outdoor water use restrictions. The state says people with home water wells should start conserving now. Let's turn to another story of note this week. Governor Chris Sununu signed an order this week creating a commission that will develop recommendations on law enforcement. It's called the New Hampshire Commission on Enforcement, Accountability, and Community and Transparency. Let's hear a little bit of what he had to say.
We are not at a crisis point in this state, but I am not one to wait for the crisis. I believe that we can always manage a better solution. So I'm asking this commission to, within the next 45 days, to reach out, engage with community stakeholders, engage with various aspects of the state, whether it be in law enforcement or schools or whatever it might be, and to really come up with some concrete and practical solutions, practical implementations that we can move forward with when it comes to reforms in our law enforcement community.
Governor Sununu calling for practical reforms in the law enforcement community. Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, I'd love to turn to you for some insight on this. What is this commission going to do specifically? Ethan, are you there?
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, we can. Sorry about that. I think we might have lost you briefly. We were starting our discussion on the New Hampshire Commission on Law Enforcement Accountability, Community, and Transparency. My question to you is, what is this commission going to do specifically?
So this commission was announced by the governor earlier this week. Essentially, it's kind of a way to for the governor to kind of look at some of the reforms that have been talked about through this movement. And so I think that there is an aspect where there will be kind of a legislative recommendation. But it's kind of looking at some of these the broader conversations that have been had nationally and how they might fit into New Hampshire. But again, with law enforcement input.
And who's on this commission?
I actually don't have the list in front of me right now for the commission.
Oh, I don't need names specifically, but our groups, which groups are represented?
To be honest, I have not followed it closely enough to have the groups in front of me. I believe it's police, union representation, and then I think there are some community leaders, but I'm unfortunately not up to date on this.
I see. Okay, so no sense on when the work will start.
No, I don't. I'm sorry, I don't have that.
Well, Jason Moon, if you're there, feel free to weigh in on this.
Yeah, my understanding is that there are police representatives. There are folks from the local chapters of the NAACP. There was a bit of controversy in that when the commission was originally announced, it did not include any members of Black Lives Matter or any of the local Black Lives Matter chapters in New Hampshire, which really were the organizers and the driving force between some of those really large demonstrations we saw in Manchester and Nashua. So it did seem a bit puzzling that they weren't included. After the governor was asked about that at a press conference, he later called and invited representatives from BLM to join the commission. So they are now represented on there. But I think that could be a potential source of tension. What Ethan was saying that there is a heavy amount of law enforcement on the commission, and that's been raised by some folks on our air. In fact, that maybe that's that might be an obstacle for the commission going forward, but. You know, the governor gave them a 45-day timeline to issue recommendations. So the good news is we don't have to wait too long as far as these sorts of things go to get to hear what the plans or recommendations might be. And then we can see if those are actually followed, if anything actually comes from this commission or, if it becomes a discussion that. And that's it. You know, we'll have to see, and I'm sure the organizers will be keen to make sure that this leads to real action as well. But that's sort of the starting point. At least that's how the governor wants to start this discussion and have this discussion going forward.
Well, this is a story that we'll certainly be following here at NHPR.org. We'll be speaking a little more about the week in New Hampshire news after a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about what's happened in the state Senate this week. If we have some time, we'll talk about a little bit more about police practices in New Hampshire and what changes are being considered. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR or email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with our guests today about the week in New Hampshire news. With me, NHPR's Jason Moon and Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor. Let's talk a little bit about the state Senate, because they met this week. Senators met this week to try to move forward with some pieces of legislation before the end of the month. The Senate was in the House chamber, which allowed for enough space for social distancing. So, Ethan, I wanted to check in with you about a few different pieces of legislation that you've been reporting on. Let's start with the effort to legislate on prescription drugs. What happened there?
Yeah, so there was a pretty big step forward in policy that was passed by the Senate this week, doing a few things for prescription drugs. One of them was putting price caps on insulin. So, as kind of many people are aware, insulin, the cost for insulin has kind of risen in recent years by kind of large amounts, I think sometimes in the hundreds of dollars per month. And apparently about 10% of New Hampshire has diabetes, according to the American Diabetes Association, about 130,000 Granite Staters. So it's a rising issue, and this legislation would cap that, cap the amount, the total amount that somebody who needs prescription insulin has to pay to $30 a month. So kind of a major change in policy there, and that was bipartisan. The other aspect that they passed in terms of prescription drugs had to do with importing wholesale drugs from Canada. This is an idea that has been kind of been tried elsewhere, and this had broad bipartisan appeal as well. It had the support of the governor, who testified, and as well as Senate and Democrats and Republicans. So that was kind of a major kind of bipartisan step forward this week for prescription drug reform.
Mm-hmm. And what about the minimum wage? Democrats have been interested in raising the minimum wage for a long time now. And was there movement this week on that?
Yeah, there was movement. And just to take a step back to kind of set the scene. So this week, there were a large number of bills passed, but it was kind of a crucial week for the whole legislature. You may remember last week, the House met and tried to take up the bills that were left on its calendar, but they had gone past their deadlines, and they needed to vote to extend those deadlines. They needed a two-thirds vote, and they didn't get that. House Republicans voted against that. So all the House bills that were on that side of the process, which would normally be about equivalent to the Senate process, those have all died. So just to set the scene, the reason why Tuesday was such a big day was that essentially the Senate had taken over the whole work of both chambers, because the House was no longer able to pass bills that originate from them. So what you saw on Tuesday was a bundling together of all these different priorities, and there had been efforts made in kind of recent weeks to try to find packages of themes, for instance, criminal justice reform, sexual assault bills, education bills that could get bipartisan support and that could pass the House and also kind of be signed by the governor. So that was kind of the backdrop. So Tuesday was sort of about kind of bipartisanship and was sort of about finding common ground. So there are a few exceptions there. I think one of them you just mentioned was the minimum wage. Democrats kind of revived their attempt that they've been making in recent years to increase New Hampshire's minimum wage. Right now it's set at $7.25. That's the federal floor. Mm-hmm. And so our minimum wage doesn't go any higher than that. It hasn't been increased since 2009. And Senate Democrats have been pushing for $12 minimum wage by 2023. The pandemic and kind of the economic realities, they kind of provided the latest backdrop. This was something that Governor Sununu vetoed last summer. So it's kind of clear where this effort's going to go. But Democrats were kind of pointing to the fallout and arguing that people, when they come back to work and when more businesses open up, there will be an incentive that for businesses to set low wages, and that this is needs to be a counterweight. But Republicans argue that this is exactly the wrong time to raise a minimum wage, especially because of the economic fallout, arguing that this would kind of hurt the ability for employers to kind of be as flexible as possible for the jobs that they'll need as the economy opens up. So it was a kind of a familiar debate that we've seen, but as everything was on Tuesday, it was charged with the new reality of COVID-19.
And what about unemployment benefits? Has the Senate made any movement on that?
Yeah, so that was one thing that was kind of hoped to be advanced by Democrats. It fell a little flat. There was an effort to extend permanently the unemployment benefit minimums that the governor had set. So essentially, before this pandemic, if you went on unemployment, if you got unemployment insurance, depending on your income, you could have as little as as $32 a week in unemployment assistance. That was raised to, I believe, $168 during this pandemic, and that was something that the Democrats wanted to keep stable after the pandemic, kind of make it permanent. And there were two Democratic senators who balked at that, who thought it was kind of too much, too fast, and that the efforts should be focused on kind of more long-term, more short-term goals when it comes to addressing the pandemic, and not something that would have long-term effects. The argument, so Republicans also had argued that when you raise the amount that is distributed through unemployment insurance, it also raises the amount that businesses in New Hampshire have to pay into the unemployment trust fund. Our unemployment trust fund is set so that if the fund goes down, if it's drawn down, then businesses have to pay more in. If the fund is filling up, the businesses have to pay less in. So there was an argument that this was kind of a hidden tax on business. So that effort did not move ahead.
And on this election year, a lot of people are concerned about how the elections will proceed in the age of COVID-19. The Senate had some discussion on election reform, yes?
Yeah, there was a package of bills, and essentially there's kind of the one question that has kind of remained about November, and it's been mostly answered by the Secretary of State's office, but it's kind of how will people vote? You know, what protections is the state going to have for people who don't feel safe voting? So as of now, the Secretary of State, Bill Gardner, has essentially found a workaround that he says doesn't require a change in law. And that's using the absentee balloting system and kind of using the existing definition of a disability to kind of count as a catch-all for the pandemic. So if you have health concerns due to the pandemic, you can claim as a disability. Democrats have been trying to kind of go further than that and create a what's called a no excuse absentee ballot system. That would be just if you can vote absentee for no stated reason at all. Right now, there are a set of reasons that you need that if you aren't using the COVID exemption. And this would kind of open that up. This is something that they've pushed for in non-pandemic times as well, it should be noted. It's something that you see kind of nationally, an argument that people should be able to vote well before election day because things can come up that are unexpected and that can kind of serve to disenfranchise people. But Republicans and the governor have argued that that's too much. That goes beyond, the needs of this pandemic. You kind of saw similar debates along those lines. So that was another effort that was pushed for was an online voter registration program, which is another kind of it's a bit of a pie in the sky idea politically with this legislature and with this governor, but it was added into the election reform package, and that passed along party lines. So there were some effort to, as I said, find bipartisan solutions on Tuesday. And there were a number of bipartisan things that did pass and kind of a number of reforms. Jason mentioned the long-term care for long-term care fund for nursing homes. And there's some rent protections. There was an elimination of the statute of limitations for civil sexual assault actions. And, you know, so there was a lot done on a bipartisan basis, but there are also a few things that will likely lead to a veto later in the summer.
Yeah, I mean, within the next few weeks that we might see a few more news articles about a variety of the things that you just mentioned.
I would say the last thing,
sure.
The kind of the headline thing that the Senate kind of pushed through was the ban on chokeholds, which in some senses is symbolic, but the Senate passed a statute. This was a 23-1 vote, so almost unanimous.
A ban on the use of chokeholds by police departments in New Hampshire.
Yes, and so that's moving ahead. That seems to have the support of the governor. He's given he's voiced support to that, and that was part of a police reform package that included other things. For instance, a misconduct reporting process that would essentially require fellow officers to act as reporters if they see misconduct and to bring that misconduct report to their superior, whether it's their police chief or otherwise, and then crucially to have that report be made public within 6 months. So there were some police reform things as well, and I should know that those were nearly unanimous.
Yeah, and before we have to sign off for the day, I wanted to turn to Jason on an issue of policing. NHPR's Jason Moon, you've been digging into municipal budgets for police around the state. Can you tell us a bit why you wanted to investigate that?
Yeah, well, as we've seen these discussions about police brutality and really just the role and size of police in America through these demonstrations over the past several weeks, you know, with calls for defunding of police and the kind of wide array of meanings that can have, we wanted to provide, or we're still hoping to provide some context for that discussion, and just to answer the basic question of, well, how much are we spending on police in New Hampshire right now? And so for the past, it's almost been 2 weeks now of trying to compile that data for our listeners and readers. And as it turns out, there is a healthy amount of discrepancy in how municipalities in New Hampshire report their spending.
Makes it hard for you to compare the data from town to town. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. It can be quite difficult. And we want to be careful, and we want to make sure that when we publish the numbers that the comparisons are fair and accurate, and it makes sense to, you know, compare the size of one city's police budget to another. But in any case, that will be something we will publish soon, maybe even as soon as today. I was hoping to be able to talk about it in more detail on this program, but as we said, we want to be careful, and we want to be sure that the comparisons are accurate. But when we do publish, folks will be able to basically just look up their community and see how much their town or city is spending on police, fire, health, and highways and streets. So some of the, you know, core government functions as we have known them, and to get a sense of, well, how much of our budget is goes towards police officers, and how does that compare with maybe the neighboring town or something like that. So we hope it'll be the resource for people to have these discussions going forward. You know, just a point of shared context that we can use as this debate unfolds. So people can look for that online either later today or early next week.
Always a good idea to keep checking NHPR.org, especially for your reporting, Jason. NHPR's Jason Moon, thank you very much for joining us on the show today. Really appreciate
it. Thank you, Peter.
And Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, thank you very much for all the work you do and for being on the program today.
Thank you, Peter.
And that's it for today, but the conversation continues online at our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange on Facebook, and you'll find us there. A reminder that earlier in the program, we talked with the organizers of the Juneteenth Manchester celebration, and there was an opportunity for folks to get tested for COVID-19 at this celebration. You can find information about getting tested for COVID-19 at the Juneteenth celebration in Manchester at the Juneteenth Manchester Facebook page, and you can also call for an appointment. That number again, 603-668-1547. Links to all the Juneteenth celebrations that we know about at our website as well, nhpr.org. And that's the show for today. Our show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Jane Vaughn is production fellow for The Exchange, and our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening. And hey, hope you find ways to stay cool on this very hot weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.